Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the most interesting developments over the past few decades of space exploration is the discovery that there are oceans beneath the icy surfaces of the moons of the outer solar system. Whereas in the past, it was thought that life could only arise in the so-called Goldilocks zone around a star, such as Earth's position 93 million miles away from the sun, there could be life hidden in oceanic environments in the depths of our solar system, on moons like Jupiter's Europa and Saturn's tiny Enceladus. Our guest is one of the best-equipped scientists to discuss the possibilities of life arising on these worlds. Kevin Hand is a planetary scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, where he directs the Ocean Worlds Lab. He's done amazing deep-sea explorations on our home planet and worked on many missions searching for the signatures of life in our solar system. He's the author of the fascinating 2020 book, Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. He joins us now from his office at JPL. Kevin Hand, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, thanks so much, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Well, before we go any further, JPL took a hard hit. The community there, your fellow scientists and everybody that works there. There were so many people lost their homes in the terrible fires there. Could you just give us a sense of, you know, how people are doing and how it kind of affected you personally, you know, with your friends?
Yeah, thanks for thinking of that, Dave. It's been an incredibly hard start to the year. I think folks are aware of the Eaton fire that just incinerated much of Altadena. And Altadena is just to the east of JPL. And in fact, a lot of credit to the JPL emergency first responders, fire department, et cetera. The fire department at JPL is creditable with having helped prevent the Eaton fire from spreading even further west. So many, many of my colleagues lost their homes. My home is safe. I'm a little further south in Eagle Rock. Yeah, everybody's just coming together throughout LA to help folks on the path to recovery from the devastating fires. So thanks for your thoughts.
Well, our hearts here at the show go out to all our friends there at JPL, especially those who lost their homes. We've been through some severe wildfires in our neck of the woods, yeah, as it is, yeah, up here. And it's tragic, but we just hope that everybody's going to be okay and recover as best they can. So thanks for sharing that.
Thanks.
All right. Well, let's talk about the fun stuff. Let's talk about your work. You wrote this wonderful book, Alien Oceans, which I thoroughly enjoyed. In fact, I would say of all the science books I've read in the last 10 years, I can't remember anything with any higher quality writing and explanatory power. When I was reading it and listening to it on Audible, I kept thinking, you know, this has Carl Sagan-esque type writing to it, the way you explain things. When did you first get really interested in space exploration in general and the search for life elsewhere? When did that get triggered for you?
Wow. Well, first, let me thank you for the high praise. That's incredibly kind of you, and means a lot to me that you enjoyed Alien Oceans. With regard to when I first started getting passionate about aliens, it really goes back to my childhood as a young boy growing up in the Green Mountain state of Vermont. The night sky of Vermont, I often credit with captivating my imagination at a young age. The cold, crisp winter night sky in particular is just so dramatic in Vermont. And I had friends and a community where we, you know, could find a universe in a mud puddle and build all sorts of model rockets and things out of balsa wood. And as I mentioned in the tribute, my parents and the community in which I grew up, and I think is well characterized by, I had a childhood few in fences but full of nets. We were encouraged to explore, follow our curiosity, and when we failed or got into trouble, which we certainly did, the community was there to catch us and help put us back on our feet.
I also saw you went to Dartmouth College. Speaking of cold places in winter, that's a very yeah, cold place, yeah, in New Hampshire. And you studied psychology and physics. Is that correct?
I did. Good eye.
Interesting combination there.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense, though, when you think about the scope of the search for life beyond Earth. The physics and astronomy is obvious, using telescopes and spacecraft to explore worlds beyond Earth. But the psychology aspect connects to my fascination with the human brain, our sensory systems, and trying to think about what communication with an alien extraterrestrial intelligence might require or take, or what, how do different brains potentially communicate? And we can think about that in the context of various cognition systems here on Earth and how challenging that is, whether it's dolphins and whales or octopi or chimps, and then expand that to civilizations beyond Earth, and the task gets even more daunting and exciting.
Well, your work focuses on the search for life in the solar system right now, and the title of your book, Alien Oceans, is just so perfect because in my lifetime, when I was a youngster growing up, there was, you know, thoughts that if there were, you know, aliens out there going around on planets, going around other suns, they had to live in the Goldilocks zone, kind of where Earth is, where it's not too hot, not too close to that star, not too far away. But then that paradigm completely shifted with the Voyager missions and the discovery that those moons of Jupiter and Saturn are far more interesting places than, you know, we had thought. And then over time, you know, the findings that Europa, you know, probably has these incredible liquid oceans of water. That's just so interesting to me to see how that has evolved through time and where we're at now. I'd like you to tell us about, you know, for yourself, when did you first get interested in these ocean worlds?
Yeah, so for me, it was towards the end of my undergraduate career in the late 90s. And that's when the Galileo mission was sending back all sorts of images and data from instruments like the magnetometer and spectrometers, indicating that Europa, this curious moon of Jupiter, has an icy shell, and beneath that icy shell, the data indicated, exists a salty liquid water ocean. And as you say, the story begins with the Voyager spacecraft, and then it extends on through the Galileo mission and the Cassini mission, which orbited Saturn and flew by many of the Saturnian moons. And when you think about the past 60 plus years of the robotic exploration of our solar system, I would argue that one of the most profound discoveries that we have made is that liquid water oceans are relatively common in our own solar system. Now, they are oceans somewhat unlike our ocean here on Earth. They are oceans trapped beneath ice shells, and they are oceans that exist in the outer reaches of our solar system. And they are oceans that do not fit that canonical, classical Goldilocks scenario that you mentioned, where, you know, in the early days of astronomy and planetary science, we had Venus, Earth, and Mars. Venus was too hot, too close to the sun. Mars, too far away, too cold. But the Earth was at just the right Earth-Sun distance so as to get enough heat from the sun to sustain and maintain a liquid water ocean on the surface in contact with a nice, relatively thick atmosphere. Well, these ice-covered moons of the outer solar system, like Europa, Enceladus, Ganymede, a host of other, maybe Titan and Mimas, and there's just this wonderful crew of ice-covered moons of the outer solar system, and they have liquid water oceans beneath their ice shells, maintained not by heating from the sun, but rather from the tidal tug and pull that they experience as these worlds go around giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. And so that mechanical tidal flexing creates internal heat, and that internal heat keeps the liquid water liquid. It's really a whole new Goldilocks paradigm for habitability.
One of the things I really enjoyed about your book is you unfold explanations beautifully to help people understand, how do we know these things? How do you know that there's an ocean below Europa? And you kind of take us through the reader through a three-step process as you kind of proceed through these chapters about Europa specifically, which is, of course, you know, the main focus right now, since we have the Europa Clipper spacecraft on its way to Europa. And I would guess that amongst most planetary scientists, it's the number one target for where you think there may be life in the solar system beyond Earth, or definitely a prime candidate, put it that way. Could you take us through that three-step process of, like, okay, how do we know that there's an ocean at Europa?
Yeah, it's I like to classify it as three easy pieces. And one of the things that I enjoy doing in the book is writing in great detail about the science behind each of these pieces. And Princeton University Press, who published the book, they were totally open to me not dumbing down a lot of this stuff. And that was really important to me, because when it comes to popular science writing, I think that audiences want more. They want more detail, provided that it's well explained, and my brain works on analogies. And so I was excited to kind of share some of these analogies. And so, as you know, I kind of go into quite a bit of detail and even have an equation or two in those chapters. And a lot of people have responded very positively to that, which has been fun to see. So the first piece of discovering that an ocean exists beneath the ice of Europa was to figure out that the surface itself was made of water ice. And so keep in mind that Galileo first discovered Europa back in 1610. And for roughly 350 years, Europa was just this point of light that orbited Jupiter. Astronomers knew it was a moon, but we didn't have much beyond that. But then in the late 50s on up through the 60s and early 70s, spectroscopy really became a tool that astronomers could use to figure out the compositions of the surfaces of worlds beyond Earth. And so the kind of first easy piece, I like to make the analogy to a rainbow connection. What do I mean by that? Well, spectroscopy is much of what I do in my lab, and spectroscopy is a fancy way of saying I study rainbows. When you look at a when you look at a rainbow out in the sky, you are seeing the light from the sun split apart into the many different wavelengths. And if you're very careful at looking at the intensity of the different colors, you can figure out interesting things about the composition of the sun, the composition of our atmosphere, the composition of those raindrops. Well, the same is true if you look at the intensity of reflected light coming off a world like, say, Europa. And so back in the 60s and 70s, astronomers were able to take spectra of Europa's surface and determine that it was made of water ice. And then the second piece of the puzzle has to do with babysitting a spacecraft. And by that, I mean that with the Galileo spacecraft going by Europa and transmitting information back to Earth, the engineers and scientists on the ground using the Deep Space Network antenna were able to very carefully track the trajectory of Europa. And I'll spare you a ton of the detail here, and I'll just refer you to the book. But simply put, by monitoring the trajectory of the Galileo spacecraft, we could then back calculate what's called the moment of inertia of Europa, and from that figure out that water in either liquid or solid phase extends down for the upper 100 to 200 kilometers on Europa. And then the last piece of the puzzle involves an analogy that I like to call adhering to airport security. And basically, the analogy is as follows. When you are going through one of those doorways at an airport, you are walking through a magnetic field that is rapidly pulsating up and down. And if you have any metal in your pocket, that pulsating magnetic field excites electric currents in that metal, which gives rise to what we call an induced magnetic field. And then detectors in the little metal detector doorway, those alarms go off and you get pulled aside and searched. Well, out in Europa, Europa is kind of like us in this analogy, and Jupiter's rotating magnetic field is kind of like the archway that you walk through. And then the Galileo spacecraft is like the little alarms that are within the doorway. And so when the Galileo spacecraft flew by with its magnetometer, with its fancy compass, the alarm went off. The Galileo mission detected an induced magnetic field at Europa. And the best explanation for that induced magnetic field is a conductive layer near the surface, and the best explanation for a conductive layer near the surface is a salty liquid water ocean beneath the ice of Europa.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with planetary scientist and deep sea explorer Kevin Hand from NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. Dr. Hand is the author of the book Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with Kevin Hand. Dr. Hand is a planetary scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he directs the Ocean Worlds Lab. He's a co-investigator on the Europa Clipper mission and the author of the recent book Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. You've also used Earth as an analog to go, you know, to think about, okay, what's it like at a place like Europa? You've gone on some really interesting submersible dives in your career, notably with James Cameron, and you open your book with that. There was a moment in the opening of your book where you're talking about kind of being stuck on the bottom, and in light of what happened recently with that submersible that imploded trying to go down to the Titanic. It was kind of gave me a shudder or two, although the people that you were working with are far more trustworthy. But that moment where you're talking about, well, if worse comes to worse, we get a wrench out to undo this. And then you thought to yourself, I hope the wrench is there. Yeah. So could you kind of take us through what it was like for you? How did you get involved in going on some of these submersible dives with James Cameron? Because what an incredible adventures those were.
Yeah, that was more than 20 years ago. Hard for me to comprehend that. But I was just a wee little grad student at the beginning of my career. And a friend of mine, now Congressman George Whitesides down here in Southern California, he was working for a company that had some connection to putting robots on the moon and getting a high-definition video link back from the moon. In any case, George reached out to me and said, hey, James Cameron is working on an IMAX movie about hydrothermal vents at the bottom of our ocean, and he's looking for a young scientist to talk about Europa while pontificating about the extremes of life here on Earth. Next thing I know, I'm looking at the Terminator statue or whatever it was somewhere here in Hollywood, and they interviewed me and then sent me off I believe it was Halifax, where I got on the Russian research vessel, the Keldysh, on board of which were two incredibly capable Russian submersibles called Mir 1 and Mir 2. And I just had an absolutely incredible time working with the Russians and with Cameron and team, making dives down to these hydrothermal vents in our ocean. And as you mentioned, these submersibles were incredibly robust. I kicked the tires on them with the Russian subpilots and engineers. And they told me, worst case scenario, in kind of broken English, my Russian's not good, their English wasn't too good. But they assured me that if all else fails, you lift up the seat in the tiny submersible, and there is a wrench. And if you just undo the nut and bolt, you'll release some ballast and eventually come back up to the surface. So sure enough, on that first dive, we ran out of battery power, and our CO2 scrubber within the submersible started to fail. And we had quite a alarming experience at the bottom of the ocean. But we connected with the other Mir submersible, and we came back up to the surface and got recovered by the Keldysh successfully. And so it was scary, but not too bad, because, you know, it is interesting, as long as your sphere inside the submersible, so in the case of the Mir submersibles, it's about, I don't know, nearly 6 feet interior diameter within the nickel steel sphere. That nickel steel sphere is incredibly strong, and all other things could fail, but with that wrench, you could release some ballast and eventually you'd surface.
Well, let's talk about those deep sea vent areas. They're so fascinating. The discovery of them around the mid-ocean ridges, that there was life at the bottom of the ocean that never sees sunlight. And that it's teeming with life that's revolving around what's called chemosynthesis instead of photosynthesis. It's not using light. It's actually using the geochemistry seeping out of the hot earth. Tell us a bit about what it was like exploring those places and some of the cool things you saw there, and maybe some of the ideas it gave you about what might be lurking beneath the icy crust in the oceans of Europa.
Yeah, and just to put it in context, those hydrothermal vents were discovered in the Pacific back in 1977, which is right around the same time when we were first landing highly capable robotic spacecraft on the surface of Mars, looking for life on Mars. And right around the same time that the Voyager spacecraft was flying by Europa and then heading outwards to Enceladus and the moons of Saturn. And so right about the same time when we're beginning to unfold the pathway to the new Goldilocks of habitability with worlds like Europa and Enceladus, we're also turning the page on our understanding of habitability here on our home planet. Nobody really thought that there would be ecosystems thriving in the deepest, darkest regions of our ocean. And yet with that exploration in the late 70s, geologists go down and find these hot springs, these hydrothermal vents, spewing out all sorts of biologically useful gases and minerals. And around these hydrothermal vents are microbial communities that, as you say, are forming the base of the food chain, doing chemosynthesis using the chemistry of the vents instead of doing primary productivity with photosynthesis, the way much of the base of the food chain on the surface of the earth is formed. And so with those microbes eating the gases and minerals at the vents, then you have larger organisms eating the microbes, forming symbioses with the microbes. And before long, you've got this ecosystem of microbes and tube worms and zoarcid fish and mussels and crabs and just, I mean, it's extraordinary. And as I describe in the book, one of my favorite parts of each dive was to get down to the bottom. And, you know, there's no GPS at the bottom of the ocean. GPS signals don't work. So what you have to do is set up some transponders, some acoustic transponders from the ship before the sub goes overboard. And then the submersible can kind of locate relative to those acoustic transponders that are down in the ocean. And you can start to kind of grid out where you're going. But every dive to a hydrothermal vent requires a bit of mowing the lawn, tic-tacking back and forth before you find the vent itself. And what I loved about that process is that one of the hallmarks of getting close to a vent was seeing the gradient of biology increase. So you get down there and it'd be completely black, and you've got some lights that give you a bit of visibility, maybe 20 or 30 feet out in front of you. And all you see is the barren seafloor, and you start to move forward. Maybe you change direction here or there. And then you see a coral, or you see a fish swim by, or maybe a crab scampering across the bottom of the ocean, and you kind of follow that. And then you see another form of life, and another, and another. And if you follow the biology, eventually it leads you to these hydrothermal events. And it was just so much fun from an exploration and discovery standpoint to seek out these oases for life at the bottom of our ocean.
Yeah, it's kind of like driving along a country road and you see a few scattered farms and animals and things. And the next thing you know, oh, we're in a town.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, here we go. Yep. And one of parts of your book I really enjoyed was your description of the Lost City deep sea vents, that structure down there. Tell us about that, because it's kind of unique and different from some of the other, like the black smoker type vents.
Yeah, so most of the hydrothermal vents that have been discovered and explored occur right along the sort of seams of the oceanic crust, where the crust is moving apart in opposite directions. And right at that seam where they're moving apart from each other are all sorts of hot springs, all sorts of hydrothermal vents. And those vents are typically exceedingly hot and very active and just really dramatic systems. But there are also fractures that kind of go perpendicular to the main rift or ridge in the oceans. And along those cracks in the oceanic crust that go perpendicular to the ridge systems, water seeps through a lot of the rock, and there's various chemical reactions that can occur that produce heat, exothermic reactions. And so starting about 24 years ago, 23 years ago, these sites that are off axis that are doing a process called serpentinization, some hydrothermal vents utilizing that geochemical process were discovered. And so Lost City was basically the first such hydrothermal vent system to be found on an off axis site. We now know of quite a few more. But what's particularly stunning and intriguing about sites like Lost City is that first and foremost, they look like massive cathedrals at the bottom of the ocean, kind of like the Gaudi Cathedral in Spain, where you've got all this precipitated white glistening carbonate at the bottom of the ocean forming these towers that are many tens of feet in height to as much as 100 plus feet in height. So first you're looking at this geologic cathedral at the bottom of the ocean, and it's just jaw-dropping. Now, granted, you know, there's no light down there, so you kind of get these little postage stamps depending on where your light is shining, and you kind of got to piece it together in your head. But then geochemically and astrobiologically, these sites are really compelling because they're lower temperature than some of the ones along the ridge. And we think that some of the chemistry of these sites, where hydrogen and methane and other compounds may be coming out, that chemistry may, and I put quotes around may be conducive to the origin of life itself. And so the thinking goes, well, if hydrothermal vent sites like Lost City are potentially good sites for the origin of life, then maybe similar sites on worlds like Europa could also have given rise to life on those worlds.
And it's really kind of neat to talk to you because we also had Dr. Robert Ballard was a guest on our show
Bob's
a couple
great.
Of years ago. Yeah. So it's like now I get to talk to two people who've been down to those mid-ocean ridges and seen those amazing sights.
Yeah. And I love chatting with Bob. Bob, you know, he's a friend through National Geographic and we've worked together on a few different things. One thing that Bob loves to say, which, you know, I get it. He loves to say, we know the surface of Mars better than we know the bottom of our own ocean. Which is correct, but rest assured that if Mars was covered with liquid water, the way our ocean is, our ocean seafloor is, we would not know the surface of Mars nearly as well. The fact that we have an ocean above the oceanic seafloor is exactly what impedes our ability to map it easily from space. We know the surface of Mars very well because it's easy to take images from space because there's no water obscuring the view of the surface.
And you are involved with some of the missions that are going on. They're the rover missions on Mars. Give me your take on briefly on what you think is unfolding in the last, you know, it has unfolded in the last couple of decades with the strategy of follow the water and the search for evidence of life on Mars. Are you hopeful that we may find something there?
Yeah, well, I've been working on the Mars Perseverance mission for 5 years now, and I am currently the principal investigator of the Sherlock spectrometer on Perseverance.
I love that name, by the way.
Yeah, quite clever. It's an acronym. I'll spare you the details on the acronym.
Yeah, but it works.
Yeah. And so with Perseverance, we have been roving up from the bottom of Jezero Crater along this ancient river delta through the river valley that breached the crater wall of Jezero, through which water flowed billions of years ago. And we're now heading on the kind of outskirts of the crater rim and further west from the crater rim. And so over the course of the past 5 years, we have collected rock cores, some of which we have good reason to predict contain organic compounds, carbon compounds. And we will get those cores back to Earth someday in the next decade or so. And we'll be able to search directly in those rock cores with the best instruments and labs here on Earth. We'll be able to search directly for evidence of past life on Mars. And, you know, it comes back to this question of, is the origin of life easy or hard? I think if the origin of life is easy, then Mars at some point in the past and maybe on through the present was or is inhabited. If the origin of life is easy, then perhaps Europa is also inhabited. If the origin of life is easy, Enceladus is potentially inhabited. Maybe Titan has some form of weird life. We just don't know. But it all hinges on that issue of the bottleneck of whether or not the origin of life is easy or hard.
One of the greatest scientific mysteries of all time, the origin of life.
It is.
You mentioned Enceladus. Let's talk about that place, that amazing small moon of Saturn's. Because, you know, before Cassini did its flybys there, I recall when I first started doing the show back in the early 2000s, my first guest ever was Gentry Lee. I'm sure you know who he is.
Friend and colleague at JPL, yeah.
Yeah, and talk about a guy who loves writing and poetry. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying something to me. He said, well, imagine, you know, designing a spacecraft to fly through the plumes of the geysers of Enceladus. And at the time he said that, the discovery of those geysers was so brand new that I didn't really know about it. I was like, geysers, Enceladus, what? And then, of course, I learned more and more about it in that coming few months in that year. Tell us about that detective story, because it's a really fascinating world that, you know, also could be a candidate for harboring life forms.
Yeah, and so Enceladus is this curious, quite small moon of Saturn. It's only about 500 kilometers in diameter, which for reference, Europa is about 3,000 kilometers in diameter. That's comparable to the diameter of our moon, of Earth's moon. So Enceladus is quite a bit smaller than Europa, and it's South Pole has got these fractures that have come to be called the Tiger Stripes. And when the Cassini spacecraft first started taking images of Enceladus, those images revealed these plumes jetting out from those fractures along the South Pole of Enceladus. Now, this, it kind of didn't make sense initially. Enceladus seemed to be too small to have much tidal heating. Its sort of orbital dynamics with the other moons did not necessarily indicate that it should have a ton of tidal heating that could enable large fractures and an ocean to exist. And yet, Mother Nature doesn't really care what we think. So with the Cassini spacecraft, the observations revealed that Enceladus sure enough has these fractures. It's got water jetting out of the fractures. And with the Cassini spacecraft flying through those plumes and tasting the material jetting out of Enceladus, sure enough, there was the discovery of salts in that plume material and organics and a host of other compounds that are indicative of a liquid water, salty, potentially habitable ocean beneath Enceladus's ice shell. So Enceladus really started out as a head scratcher. It's still a head scratcher, but we take the evidence as it's given to us, and boy, do we ever want to get back out to Enceladus to see whether or not it hosts life.
Yeah, because it's literally spewing that stuff out into space, saying, "Hey, you want to know what's going on deep inside here? Just, we're throwing it out there. Come get it.
Exactly.
Come check it out." So it's very interesting.
A prime place. World for a mission that flies through those plumes with highly capable instruments that can tell us the nature of the organics and whether or not there's any life within that material.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with NASA planetary scientist Kevin Hand. Dr. Hand is the director of the Ocean Worlds Lab at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, a co-investigator on the Europa Clipper mission, and author of the recent book, Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our visit with planetary scientist Kevin Hand from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory as we talk about the search for life in the oceans of other worlds. Well, let's talk about a spacecraft that has some highly capable instruments that's on its way to Europa right now, the Europa Clipper mission. Give us a little overview of that mission and your role on it.
Yeah, so Europa Clipper launched this past October, October 14th, if memory serves. And that was a number of days, perhaps even a week later than the start of the launch window. And the reason it got delayed is because a hurricane barreled through the panhandle of Florida and basically went right over the launch pad. So it was a dramatic lead up to the launch. And then when the launch occurred and everything went smoothly, I was brought to tears just because it's been so long and such great anticipation. I started on various mission architectures for exploring Europa not long after the Galileo mission was sent into the atmosphere of Jupiter in its end of life scenario. And so I think the first NASA science definition team that I was involved with as a member was in 2006. And so here we are nearly 20 years later, and we finally have a mission launched to head out back to Europa.
So tell us about some of the instrumentation on Europa Clipper and some of the questions you're most interested that instrumentation can delve into.
Yeah, so I'm a co-investigator on one of the instruments, a mass spectrometer that is specifically designed to sample material that's coming off of Europa's surface, either from sputtering or from, say, plumes jetting out from fractures on Europa. Now, the mission as a whole, the Clipper mission, has as its primary goal to assess the habitability of Europa. First and foremost, to really give us more information and confidence about the nature of that liquid water ocean that we have a high degree of confidence exists beneath the icy shell. But, you know, we don't know how thick the ice is. We don't know how deep the ocean is. We don't know much about the chemistry of the ocean at this point. And so a lot of the instruments are designed to help characterize the surface chemistry and the geology of Europa to better understand the ocean. And by understanding the chemistry of the ocean, then we can assess the habitability. So the Clipper mission will do this by going into orbit around Jupiter. And that will happen about 6 years from now. This business is not for the faint of heart. It launched this past October of 2024. And it'll take about 6 years until it arrives in the Jovian system. So that'll be around this time in the year 2030. But even then, we're not going to be doing our flybys of Europa. The Clipper spacecraft needs to pinball around the Jovian system and lose some of its velocity before we can go into the right orbit that will allow us to investigate Europa up close. And that orbit is going to be around Jupiter. So we're not going into orbit around Europa. We're going into orbit around Jupiter. But it's this highly elliptical orbit that takes about 2 weeks per ellipse petal. And with each of those ellipses, we will fly by Europa very closely. Flybys are in the range of several tens of kilometers to several hundred kilometers above Europa's surface. And that's just astonishing when you think about how far away Jupiter is, how far away Europa is. As a scientist, I get to search for life and be a part of these missions, but it's really the engineers who figure out the hard stuff, who figure out how to get a many-ton spacecraft to fly just tens of kilometers above Europa's surface so that we can collect the imagery and spectroscopy and ice-penetrating radar so as to then better understand this mysterious world.
Yes, and in the long history of NASA is that wonderful partnership between scientists who want to understand things and the engineers that give them the tools to be able to investigate those things.
That's exactly right. The engineers make it possible. We scientists get to come up with the crazy ideas and say, please help us get this done.
Yeah, it's a neat partnership. Okay. Towards the end of your book, you mentioned Weird Life and Titan earlier. Maybe we can use Titan as an example. You do what I loved that Carl Sagan did in the original Cosmos television series. He said it right up front. We will be sure that, you know, when we're talking about scientific knowledge and what we know, and then we won't be afraid to speculate. Mm-hmm. And we'll make that clear when we're doing that. And he did that wonderfully. You like to go into the realm of, you know, let's speculate, what could life be like? Because it could be very different from what we expect. And that was a really interesting part of the book for me. I love the title of one of the chapters was, I think, The Octopus and the Hammer.
Yeah.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about The Octopus and the Hammer.
Yeah, thanks. That's my favorite chapter. And thank you for the kind words on that kind of progression. Because as you know, the book starts out with a lot of hard science and history, and I want to make sure that the reader has got a good understanding of the data and the physics and the chemistry behind why we think we know what we know about these alien oceans. And then in the later chapters, I kind of open the door to more speculation. And in that chapter, I believe it's chapter 12, as you mentioned, I call it The Octopus and the Hammer. And I just kind of put out this thought experiment of, well, okay, we think that Europa and some of these alien oceans may have the conditions for microbial life to exist. But what if evolution doesn't stop there? Is there any way for more complex life to emerge? And if there is there any way in which that more complex life might eventually start using tools and technology and develop into a civilization deep within the ocean of a world like Europa? So, yeah, the all bets are off in that chapter. But that's actually where my psychology degree comes into play, because one of the things that I enjoyed studying as part of that degree was different senses. What, you know, we have our five senses as humans, but other creatures on Earth have got obviously sonar in the case of bats and dolphins, etc. There is electro sensing in the case of sharks, and sensing of the polarization of light by bees and a number of other creatures. So in that chapter, I go into these different sensory modalities a bit and start to think about how octopi or European equivalent octopi might be able to communicate and use tools and potentially build a civilization around hydrothermal vents, where the vents kind of serve as the nexus for the chemistry and the materials that they need to build up their worlds and their communities. So I'm glad you enjoyed that, and it was a lot of fun to write. And I tried to keep a bit of a tether of realism there, while also not letting it be too much of an impediment to kind of thinking outside the box.
Yeah, and I love thinking about aquaculture being done by these alien beings around the deep ocean vents and farming them. You know, that just a really fascinating thing to think about.
And as you know from the book, there's a nugget of truth in that. One of the hydrothermal vents that I visited in the Atlantic, a place called Snake Pit, there the hydrothermal vent had this like Dr. Seussian structure to it, with these clamshell kind of structures coming out with the cup facing upward, and within those clamshells were these baby shrimp. And it seemed like the geology and the biology of the vent forming and the shrimps, the shrimp community that lives around the vent, coexisted in a way so as to help nurture the life around the chimney. So yeah, that kind of aquaculture farming and biological, geological symbiosis, I think may actually have an interesting connection to what I've seen here on Earth.
One of my own speculations after reading your book was to imagine into the future a James Cameron in the future and a Kevin Hand in a submersible that has penetrated the ice of Europa and going down there and investigating and seeing what's down there for the very first time.
Well, you at the end of the IMAX film that Cameron made called Aliens of the Deep, there is an animated sequence where you can see sort of a prelude to an Avatar-esque kind of civilization at the bottom of a foreign, distant, ice-covered alien ocean.
Well, before we let you go, what's on the horizon for you? Anything really interesting coming up for you in the next year?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. We've got our continued roving on Mars with Perseverance. We're collecting samples and continuing to do analyses of the rocks we encounter with Perseverance. And then I've always got lab experiments going, and I've got a project with an amazing team where we're working up in the Alaskan Arctic, up in the near the town of Utqiagvik. And there we're deploying a robotic under ice rover called the Buoyant Rover for under ice exploration. And that rover is designed to study the ice water interface and to study methane coming out of the Arctic permafrost. And this is a project that brings together our search for habitable environments beyond Earth, where methane is kind of like a harbinger of habitability, a canary in the coal mine for a world potentially having life. You know, if you find methane on Mars or Europa or Enceladus, that's a good hook for habitability. So we're developing tools and robotic systems to map and study that methane coming out of the permafrost up in Alaska. But coupled with that, the work that we're doing is very important to understanding our changing planet. As your listeners likely appreciate, carbon dioxide, of course, is an important greenhouse gas. Methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas. And as our planet warms, more and more methane may be coming out of the high latitude permafrost regions. And we need to do a better job of quantifying what's coming out of the permafrost and how that is contributing to our changing planet. So our project up in Alaska is just one small but exciting project where we're working to better understand what's happening here on Earth, while also building a bridge to systems that could someday be used to explore worlds like Europa.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for being with us, and best of luck with Europa Clipper, and to your colleagues at JPL that have had a very rough start to 2025 with the terrible Eaton fire.
Thank you so much, Dave, and a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks again to our guest, Kevin Hand, director of the Ocean Worlds Lab at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. You can get his wonderful book, Alien Oceans, The Search for Life Beyond Earth, at most major booksellers or order it from your local community bookstore. You can learn more about his work at oceanworldslab.jpl.nasa.gov. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.